From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. With just 3 weeks remaining in baseball's regular season, will the Padres have to call the Giants their daddies? Are the Yankees still the Yankees? And if they are, do the Rays realize that? Today on Only a Game, ESPN's Tim Kirkjian answers those questions. Also, while American tennis fans scratch their collective heads, John McEnroe and his brother Mark look to improve U.S. tennis.
It's not so much that the U.S. has fallen behind as that the other countries have caught up. The world's a big place, and it's just a much deeper pool of really terrific players out there.
And a good walk, not so spoiled. Only a Game's Karen Gibbon visits the world of professional disc golf. Stay tuned.
Major funding for Only a Game comes from Oliver Wyman, an international strategy consulting firm. With 3,000 professionals worldwide, Oliver Wyman serves global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. The wise guys say that San Diego's squandering their chance, but Cincinnati's punched their ticket to the autumn dance. The Yankees, too, can make that claim. The Rangers can as well, and prospects for the Twins and Rays are also looking swell. I'm pretty sure ESPN's Tim Kirkjian will agree with at least most of that, although perhaps not the part about San Diego. Tim, the Padres have struggled over the past week or so. Do they hold off the Giants or make it to the playoffs as a wild card?
I'm going to say they are going to win the division and go to the playoffs. I think the wild card's coming out of the NL East, not the NL West. And even though the Padres have hit the skids badly here and they're a young team that hasn't been here before, I still like their chances. Their pitching has been so good all year. Their defense has been so good all year. They added two bats in Ryan Ludwig and Miguel Tejada for the stretch run. I think they're going to hold on and beat the Giants, and I say that because I picked them fourth in the division, and they'll do anything to make me look like an idiot.
Elsewhere in the National League, Cincinnati would seem to be the only lock. The Reds have an insurmountable lead in the NL Central since the Cardinals have lost more often than they've won in September. But what about the National League East?
Both teams in that division, the Braves and the Phillies, are going to the playoffs in my mind. One is the wild card, one is the division leader. And I'm telling you, Bill, we've seen this movie before. The Phillies are loading up for the stretch run. They did it the last 2 years and made it to the World Series. And I think with the way they're going, that is improved health and two real aces at the top of the rotation, Roy Halladay and Roy Oswalt. And with Ryan Howard, whose best month historically is September, and the same thing is happening this year, I think they're on another run to the playoffs and maybe another run to the World Series. And remember, no National League team has been to the World Series 3 years in a row, the Cardinals in the 40s. That's where I think the Phillies are headed.
Texas is only about 15 games over 500, but that's good enough for a comfortable lead in their division, the West. Will the Rangers be overmatched no matter whom they face in the playoffs?
I think they're in trouble in the playoffs, Bill, for two reasons. Cliff Lee and Josh Hamilton. Cliff Lee was the best pitcher in the American League when they acquired him, and now he's got a bad back, and that followed four real subpar starts. To me, their only chance to do something in the playoffs against the Yankees and the Rays is to have Cliff Lee at the absolute top of his game, and he is not right now. Josh Hamilton is the MVP of the American League at this point, but he's injured, and there's no telling when he's coming back. And if their two stars, Hamilton and Lee, are not 100%, I don't like the Rangers in the postseason. If they are 100%, I like the Rangers a lot.
The White Sox won seven games in a row right after acquiring Manny Ramirez from the Dodgers, but that mystique eventually wore off. Any chance Chicago catches the Twins?
I don't see it, Bill. There's something special going on with the Twins right now. Their starting pitching since the All-Star break has been the best in baseball, and I don't know anyone that saw that coming. More important than that, they have filled in for Justin Morneau, who's got a concussion and has been out over a month. they've done that beautifully with Jason Kubel moving to the outfield, Michael Kodaira to first base, and most important, Jim Thome, age 40, has come in and just been a tremendous offensive player for them. He is a Hall of Fame player, Bill. He's going to hit over 600 home runs in his career. He's got more than 20 homers again this year, and I'm amazed how productive he still is at this age, and boy, has he come through when his team really needed him.
The New York Yankees have the best record in baseball, and so I suppose that's your cue to say the Yankees are still the Yankees.
They still are, Bill, but they have issues going into the postseason. Of course, we say this every year, but they got a really good boost the other night when Andy Pettit threw four scoreless innings in a minor league rehab start. And now it appears, barring a change or barring a setback, that he'll be ready to go for like the last 2 weeks of the regular season, and that groin injury appears to have healed. If so, the Yankees are going to be the team to beat going into October, but that's only with improved health from Pettit and Alex Rodriguez and the rest of that lineup on full cylinder. This is a really, really good team, but not as good as the team that rolled into the postseason last year.
Tampa Bay, 30 or so games over 500 have been sustained by excellent pitching. All the smart people I know say pitching is the most important variable in the postseason. So, do the Rays perhaps win everything this year?
I think the Rays will go into October as the second-best team in the major leagues behind the Yankees. However, if the Yankees have injury issues and get a little bit old all of a sudden, which seems to be happening on some level, the Rays could jump in, not just win the pennant, they could win the World Series this year. Because they also know that Carl Crawford, their basically best all-around player, he's going to leave via free agency after the year, and so might Carlos Pena, their first baseman. So they all know, and they've known since day one, of this year, we have to win. The window's open. They may jump through it because the window's not going to be as open next year as it is right now.
Tim, normally I would say that mid-September is no time to talk about next spring, but next spring, Barry Bonds will go on trial for perjury, as will Roger Clemens. Both of them would be locks for the Hall of Fame if we were to consider nothing but their statistics. What are your feelings as you anticipate these two trials?
Well, I'm really sad, Bill, and it's really sad and bad for baseball that the best pitcher I have ever seen and the best hitter that I've ever seen, and I'm too young to have seen Ted Williams, and I'm obviously too young to have seen Walter Johnson, even though I went to Walter Johnson High School in Bethesda. These two guys are they're the best I've ever seen, and they, one of them, Roger Clemens, might end up going to jail. I don't think Barry Bonds is, but either way, when you have a much-publicized trial, two of them involving two guys that just carried the game in different ways for a couple of decades, it is really, really sad for baseball, and the sooner this gets over, the better, and I can't say, boy, I hope they don't go to jail, but I just hope this thing gets over with so we can move on to the stuff on the field, because next spring, this is going to dominate the landscape, unfortunately.
Tim Kirkjian covers baseball for ESPN, and he joins me from time to time to talk about same. Tim, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Bill.
Today, the Red Sox are in Oakland playing the A's in a game not likely to matter at all in the American League standings. It's also the 9th anniversary of the terrorist attacks on September 11th. Those two events may not seem to have anything to do with each other, but a new program brings the Red Sox together with veterans of Afghanistan and Iraq who are now suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder or traumatic brain injuries. Only a Game's Monica Brady Meyerhoff reports.
John Zagami looks like a healthy 26-year-old. He has a long-distance runner's body and a buzz cut. He recalls the moment his life changed.
Well, we were doing crowd control at a checkpoint, and then, you know, I fell down somehow, don't remember.
It was 2003 in Iraq. Zagami was an Army specialist.
I don't remember most of that day or, you know, the following days after. I was in kind of like a trance or a daze. Finally, when I kind of woke up a few days later, I remember like being nauseous and throwing up all the time and saying, well, what is this from? It can't be food poisoning. Like, I don't know what's going on. And ever since then, I've had like blinding headaches and my balance has been off. And there's just, you know, it's one issue after another which led up to that stroke.
The stroke happened after Zagami returned and was a freshman in college. Soon after, he was diagnosed with a traumatic brain injury and post-traumatic stress disorder, or PTSD. He has trouble sleeping, a terrible short-term memory, and headaches that make him pass out. For 6 years, he's been getting treatment through the Veterans Administration.
After, you know, just getting frustrated with the VA system and so many different doctors and having doctors cycle through, you know, and it was like every time I'd show up for an appointment, it would be a new neurologist or a new cardiologist or, you know, whatever. You just get beat down after a while and just say, all right, I'm going to have to live with these health issues the rest of my life. And it's not a fun way to live.
But he got a little hopeful when his sister told him about a new program she heard about while watching a Red Sox game on TV.
And for those veterans and their families, there's a new team being created to support you. It's called the Red Sox Foundation.
That's Tim Wakefield, pitcher and pitch man for the Home Base Program. It's funded by the Red Sox Foundation, which has teamed up with Mass General to provide free care for vets with PTSD and traumatic brain injury. Red Sox chairman Tom Werner says the idea came to him in 2007 when the team won the World Series and visited Walter Reed Army Medical Center. Werner saw how the vets responded to players.
David Ortiz is a hero to them, but he thinks they're heroes because you just see these average guys who, you know, come from all over the country who just wanted to give something back to their country and are now in great pain. So I think there was just a general sense of what can we do to help.
Home Base started in 2009 and recently opened its own clinic near Mass General. The program has treated more than 200 veterans and their families. That's a small portion of the 12,000 Massachusetts vets with mental disorders who get help from the VA. Still, Ross Zafont, director of traumatic brain injury for Home Base, says the program complements what the VA offers.
I think what the Red Sox Home Base program offers is an alternative route for many reluctant veterans or our nation's heroes to begin to seek care.
To be honest, it's also something that's kind of embarrassing to do.
Army veteran Sergeant George Carvalho lost the fingers of his right hand in Iraq and only reluctantly admits he has deeper, invisible wounds.
You're a soldier. You're supposed to be strong. You know, you're not supposed to have any weakness. And, you know, to admit it is the biggest and first step.
He took the first step because Home Base is affiliated with the Red Sox.
Been a fan since I was very, very little. And to me, it's one of the greatest things to see is a sports organization step up and do this for the veterans.
John Zagami is also a huge Sox fan. He watched the first World Series win via satellite in Iraq. He never thought he'd have this close a connection to the team. The Home Base program has really helped him, he says. He sleeps better and has fewer night terrors.
You know, as long as I'm feeling better and making progress, I feel like there's hope, you know, like we can keep moving forward. And I never got that feeling at the VA. I just felt like I was another victim and that you kind of had to deal with it.
The Home Base program will treat any veteran for free, but is focusing its efforts on those who served since 9/11. For Only a Game, I'm Monica Brady-Myrov in Boston.
It's 19 minutes past the hour. You can be a criminal and play Xbox Live. You can be cruel to your pets, inconsiderate of the feelings of your loving parents, and filthy dirty. But if you want to play Xbox Live, you can't live just anywhere. That's what Josh Moore found out when he completed one block of his registration form with the name of his hometown, Fort Gay, West Virginia. The Microsoft Corporation accused Moore of violating their code of conduct and suspended his gaming privileges, assuming he was slurring gays. Eventually, someone at Xbox Live did untangle the confusion, and Mr. Moore's gaming privileges were restored, but by then he hadn't played in several days, and his skills had deteriorated dramatically. I made that last part up. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, whatever happened to the Vic dogs? But first, in U.S. Open action today, Kim Clijsters will face Vera Zvonareva in the women's final. Clijsters outlasted Venus Williams in a three-set match yesterday afternoon. On the men's side, Roger Federer will face Novak Djokovic, and Rafael Nadal will take on Mikhail Yuzny in semifinal action. And if you're not hoping for a Federer-Nadal final, why aren't you? For the second consecutive Open, no U.S. man made it to the quarterfinals. Those who are dismayed by how poorly U.S. men have fared at this and lots of other recent pro tennis tournaments may have reason for hope. The day after the Open ends, the John McEnroe Tennis Academy on Randall's Island in New York will officially welcome its first class of players. Joining me now to talk about same is Mark McEnroe, the middle of the McEnroe brothers. Mark McEnroe, welcome to Only a Game.
Thanks for having me.
There are tennis academies aplenty in Florida, Texas, and California. Tell me a little bit about how the McEnroe Academy will differ from these.
Primary differences, I think, are we don't have a residential component to this, nor do we have an educational component to it, per se. We're not a boarding school. We don't have, you know, dormitories for kids to stay. John's belief is that a child, even in today's environment, can have an upbringing that was similar to ours and still come out as a highly accomplished player. And by that, we mean, you know, you're going to live at home with your parents, you're going to go to the school you've been going to or whatever school you want to go. You're going to be a full-time student first, you're going to be a tennis player second, and you're not going to go to a, you know, a boarding school environment at a young age, which we think could help lead to the burnout that you see with a number of young kids, or you don't see because you never hear of them because they've checked out before they even get close to the big time.
Your brother John has said that part of the purpose of the John McEnroe Tennis Academy will be to develop top 10 male players. How soon is that likely to happen?
Top 10 in the world?
Yeah.
You know, that's going to be a few years off, to be totally honest. We're focused for junior players. We have a very strong group of very young players, you know, from 8 years old to 12, 13. We have, you know, some older players who are in their middle teens who are not as accomplished yet as tournament players as some of the younger guys. So, you know, unless we catch lightning in a bottle with one of the 14 or 15-year-olds, we're looking at at least a five-year plan here.
I assume there will be female players at the McEnroe Academy as well.
Absolutely. The focus is to get top professional players, you know, male or female. Our program is pretty equally split down the middle between, you know, boys and girls. John has become a big supporter of women's tennis as a father of three daughters, so that's something we absolutely are looking to do.
Your younger brother Patrick was hired 2 years ago by the U.S. Tennis Association to run an elite player development program. Patrick, of course, was also an elite player and recently resigned after a long tenure as the U.S. Davis Cup team captain. Will he be competing with brother John, or will their efforts be complementing each other?
Hopefully, and the expectation is that we'll be complementing each other. I mean, at some level, there may be a terrific player who Patrick would want to put in his program who we'd love to have here. I'm sure that's going to happen. We're all aiming for the same thing. We may be going at it in different ways. I mean, Patrick has a view. His program, from what I understand, is more emulating what's been happening in France and Spain for the last few years, where they group their most serious kids together, ideally in a residential environment. But we don't think it's the only way up the mountain. One of our first things that we're looking at is to give a real alternative for people who want top-level coaching and not have to completely change their family dynamic.
It's interesting that you bring up what other countries have done. How much of the relative decline among American men in tennis is just part of the improvement of tennis training in other nations?
I think it's a big part. I mean, one of the things that John says, and I think Patrick would agree with, is it's not so much that the U.S. has fallen behind as that the other countries have caught up. Tennis is probably not choice number one for most American kids. There's basketball, there's football, there's baseball. You know, so tennis is kind of down the list. If you look at where, you know, a lot of the top-level pros now are coming from, Federer to the side, and the Spaniards have been very strong for a number of years. You have a lot of people from Eastern Europe. There, I think they're getting tennis is kind of choice A, you know, 1 or 1A with soccer.
Mm-hmm.
So they're really getting tremendous athletes. And if you look at the size of the players now, you know, Thomas Berdych, who just got to the finals of Wimbledon, and Djokovic, I mean, these are big guys, you know, Söderling, 6'3", 6'4", 6'5-inch guys who are tremendous athletes. Obviously, that's not going to necessarily mean you're going to be a champion, but you'd rather be that size with that kind of mobility than be 5'8".
The director of tennis at the McEnroe Academy is Gilad Blum. Tell us a little bit about his qualifications for the job.
Well, Gilad was a former top 60 player, singles and doubles. He was an Israeli Davis Cupper, played on the Olympic team for them. Since he retired, he's worked in Israel with their national program. And then he's been running a program here in New York for the last 10 years. He takes little tiny kids in what continues to amaze me and teaches them, you know, perfect strokes and good focus and the footwork and all the things that are critical to building a tennis player.
How much will John himself be involved in tennis instruction?
As I tell the parents, you know, the good news and the bad is you're going to get a lot of Johnny Mac. You know, John has been involved with this club and this facility, you know, since January. I don't think John is going to spend a tremendous amount of time on a court, you know, hitting balls at kids, but he is going to spend a tremendous amount of time on the court, stopping on each court, talking to the kids, pointing things out for them. He remembers well and aspires to be Harry Hopman, who was the inspirational leader of Port Washington Tennis Academy when we were kids. That's his goal, and I think he's going to be great at it.
All right, I can't resist asking one final question. You are the brother of John and Patrick McEnroe. Are you any good at tennis?
Relatively speaking to that, no, I'm pretty bad. Relative to other players, I'm pretty good. I went to Stanford as well. I was a walk-on on the team for my sophomore year. Never played a match, but I still compete against other old guys and enjoy it a lot. One of the perks of my job is I get to play more with some great people. So I'm not anywhere near the level of either John or Patrick, but trying to hold my own.
Mark McEnroe, brother to John and Patrick, is the general manager of the John McEnroe Tennis Academy, which will begin operations next week. Mark, you're a good sport, and thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you, Bill.
On August 23, 2007, Michael Vick, who'd been a star with the NFL's Atlanta Falcons, pleaded guilty to charges that he'd financed and participated in a dogfighting venue on his property. Vick served 21 months in jail and filed for bankruptcy in July of 2008. On August 13th of 2009, having been reinstated by the NFL commissioner, Roger Goodell, Vick signed a contract with the Philadelphia Eagles. He started at quarterback for the Eagles in their final exhibition game last week. In The Lost Dogs, subtitled Michael Vick's Dogs and Their Tale of Rescue and Redemption, Jim Gurant tells the story of the victims of the crime which sent Vick to prison. He joins me now from NPR's New York Bureau. Jim, welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you.
Remind us, please, of how the dogfighting operation on Michael Vick's property in Virginia was discovered and of the extent of that operation.
It was actually a police dog on a regular patrol outside a club, picked up the scent of marijuana. When the owner came out, he was arrested, and he turned out to be Michael Vick's cousin by the name of Davin Bodie, who was living at Vick's house at the time. Some local authorities who had had some suspicions about the location to start with used that as probable cause to initiate a drug search of the property. And when they went to search for the drugs is when they discovered the dogs. And it was pretty extensive. They found 66 dogs on the property when they arrived and various sorts of equipment and training paraphernalia. They also found some firearms and some drug paraphernalia as well.
Tell us about the condition of the dogs discovered on the Vick property.
Yeah, there's been some various reports. Some initial reports said they were in bad shape, but I've since heard talking to people who were there that day that they weren't so bad. Most of the time, dogs in a dogfighting operation are kept thin because fights are scheduled and arranged at a certain weight, just like, you know, boxing. And so it's always easier to build a dog up for a fight than to get it to lose weight. So the dogs, maybe to some people who didn't know better, appeared very thin, but they, as my understanding was, they were healthy.
Of course, some of the dogs they eventually discovered on the property were dead and had been buried, and I understand some of them did have parasites that are common to dogs engaged in dogfighting.
That's right. There's a few diseases, bloodborne diseases, that are mainly passed through dogfighting, and some of them have that. And I know over time some of the dogs have really struggled where, you know, their condition has really worsened based on the disease, but then they've been able to find a good mix of drugs that have helped them. So, yeah, like you said, what finally really made the case for the federal government was the discovery of some dead dogs on the property, which not only proved that dogs were being killed there, but the ways in which they were being killed.
Eventually, some of these dogs, dogs that had been trained to go after each other and try and kill each other, earned certification as therapy dogs. What does that mean exactly?
You know, there's a couple of different ways therapy dogs work. Sometimes they go into hospitals and sort of visit with, you know, sick or ailing patients to give them some comfort and companionship. There are a couple that involved in reading programs with kids where they go into libraries and kids come in and read to the dogs, which, A, not only gets kids into the library, but then also if there are kids who have issues about reading in front of other people, they, you know, the dog is a very receptive and forgiving audience. It's hard to say the dogs did this or the dog did that because one of the key findings in all this is that you have to look at each dog individually. You know, mm-hmm. That was one of the key precedents this set. And instead of saying all these dogs should be put down or all these dogs should be kept alive, what they did was they went in and evaluated each dog individually. And there was a sort of a separate plan based on each one's abilities and needs. And one of the big messages going forward is that, you know, whether it's a pit bull or a collie or a poodle, there's some potential for good or bad, and you have to look at each dog, but what the potential for that individual dog is.
In the process of researching this book, you followed the progress of some of the dogs as various people worked with them as they got out of kennels and shelters and came into people's homes. Did you end up having a favorite among the dogs?
That's a good question. I was really moved by, there was one dog, Sweet Jasmine. There was something about her struggle in particular. She was one of the dogs that really struggled with her fear and anxiety, and just watching her try and work through it, you know, it's hard to say one was a favorite, but I was particularly touched by her for some reason or another.
What are her current circumstances?
Well, I can't get into all that. That would give away the ending of the book.
Okay, fair enough. Michael Vick was a wealthy and celebrated football player before his activities at 1915 Moonlight Road were discovered. Now he's a pretty wealthy football player again, although he's still repaying his creditors. Do you think the story of his involvement with dogfighting has changed the extent to which dogfighting goes on in this country or the public perception of the crime?
I think there has been an impact from it. Certainly it was the most high-profile case of its kind, and I mean, I've been told that the less serious among those out there decided this is the time for me to get out. It also had an impact within the law enforcement community. People liked the case, taxpayers liked the case, and it proved that it was prosecutable. And so it became something that law enforcement was more willing to take on. There was a lot of positives involved, and we've seen a couple of very big dogfighting busts since the Michael Vick case. And I think that's a result of all the notoriety that came out of this particular case.
Jim, we've talked a lot about the dogs, and I know you don't want to give away the ending of your book regarding any of the specific dogs involved, but let's talk a little bit about Michael Vick. The word redemption is in the title, vis-a-vis the dogs. What about Michael Vick?
Well, he seems to have earned some degree of that. I mean, he plays every week. Every Sunday he goes out there, and there's not a huge protest. There are people that are very unhappy that he's out there. But at the same time, a lot of sports fans seem to have accepted him back. Whether or not that means he's redeemed or not is another question, I suppose. He has continued to work with the Humane Society, as he promised, doing some events. Having not been there personally, I don't want to characterize how they've gone. You know, I think it's an ongoing thing for him. I think if he continues to do the right thing, time is on his side. But it's probably a question only he can answer.
Jim Gurant is the author of The Lost Dogs, Michael Vick's Dogs and Their Tale of Rescue and Redemption, available for pre-orders now and in stores on Thursday. Jim Gurant joined me from NPR's New York Bureau. Jim, thanks very much for speaking with me.
Thanks for having me.
You're listening to Only a Game. They're laying off the crossing guards. The kids are on their own while walking to the schools where budgets haven't really grown, as salaries have been frozen for the teacher and the aide. For years, our roads and bridges haven't really made the grade. But never mind these problems and the overwhelming need. Tom Brady's set to get some $50 million guaranteed. I do not blame Tom Brady. Hey, for all that I can see, he is a pleasant guy and just the same as you or me, except that you and I can't lead the Patriots down the field. See, I, faced with that challenge, would immediately yield the ball to any bruiser who politely asked for same. And if you wish to keep your head, you'd probably do the same. So maybe $18 million every year is what's required to find yourself a quarterback by whom the team's inspired enough to keep the many millions more cascading in. That's why, if you are the owner, you pay out the dough and grin. You spend the bucks to make them. That's how this equation works. If you are in the owner's club, you know that there are perks. You get the help you say you need to keep the team at home, and everybody waves their great big fingers made of foam. The rich get richer, so it goes. The stars will always shine, and those who have no jobs keep making up a longer line than any line for tickets at the weekend's biggest game. It's been thus for a while, I guess, and so it's still the same. But do not blame Tom Brady for the millions that he makes. For hauling in a bundle, he has what it clearly takes. Nor will he keep the title of the highest paid, I'm told. For here is a prediction, and it isn't very bold. Jim Irsay, he who owns the Colts, says he won't be exceeded at paying to a quarterback much more than could be needed. So Peyton Manning's contract, when the deal is finally made, will make Tom Brady feel that he is badly underpaid.
You know the best things in life are free. What you can give them to the birds and bees. I need money.
It will cost you nothing to contact us through our website, onlyagame.org, where you can also view our photo galleries and learn about the music you hear on the show each week. You can also leave a message on the listener line by calling 617-353-1860. And you can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Only A Game Radio. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Oliver Wyman, an international strategy consulting firm. With 3,000 professionals worldwide, Oliver Wyman serves global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com. And Nuance, offering Dragon speech recognition software for creating documents and emails and surfing the web all by speaking. At nuance.com/NPR. This is NPR.
Earlier this week, blogger Matthew Yoder paired up each NFL team with a character from The Simpsons. So do you agree with Mr. Yoder that the gosh darn likability of Peyton Manning and the Indianapolis Colts are best personified by Ned Flanders?
Oh, indeedly doodly.
How about the New York Jets as Homer Simpson, because Jets head coach Rex Ryan is a big, fat, loudmouth who loves attention.
All my life I've been an obese man trapped inside a Batman's body.
We should probably stop before we get to Mr. Yoder's contention that the Dallas Cowboys and Mr. Burns are insane, power-hungry billionaires separated at birth.
As punishment for your desertion, it's company policy to give you the plague.
Oh, dear. I'm Bill Littlefield, coming up on Only a Game, golf, in which you can lose your driver in a water hazard by mistake. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a look at the week's news, and he's in North Carolina this week. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill, and hello to our new friends at WNCU HD2, which is not far from here, from where I'm sitting, so I don't have to yell very loud.
Yeah, they're in Durham, and
That's
we're happy
right.
to have
I'm
them
Winston-Salem,
with us.
So there we are.
The National Football League season began on Thursday night when the New Orleans Saints managed what they called an ugly win over the Minnesota Vikings. Everybody else plays tomorrow or on Monday. Does any particular matchup delight you with its potential?
Well, I think the most interesting one in terms of everything that doesn't have anything at all to do with football, because I know that's the way you like to look at the
Absolutely.
National Football has to be Baltimore and New York Jets in the Monday, the first Monday night game of the season, given the fact that the Jets were an HBO reality series through the entire preseason. And they're running up against a team that, you know, led by Ray Lewis, who's already started talking about this, would delight in knocking the stars of HBO back, you know, prior to the days before cable television. So I think if you're looking for some serious hitting, that's going to be the game.
You think the coach's language in that HBO series has made a lot of enemies for the Jets before the season even begins?
Oh, come on. The guy wasn't even in the same ballpark with the guys on Deadwood, for God's sake.
Tom Brady and the New England Patriots have agreed to a new contract for the quarterback. It will pay him $72 million over the next 4 years. That makes Brady the highest paid player in the National Football League. How long before Peyton Manning and the Indianapolis Colts settle on $73
million? I think, Bill, if you watch your watch very carefully, it may be happening already. This is the latest in the arms race. This obviously gives mockery to the whole notion that we're headed towards, labor management Armageddon in the NFL because the NFL is somehow struggling financially. Peyton Manning's going to get his too, but Tom Brady seems to be, you know, perfectly happy. I hope they have a clause in there for them controlling the intersections in Back Bay, though.
Yeah, you're referring to Tom Brady's car accident earlier this week. Happily, he walked away from that one.
Right.
Moving on, you want to pick the Super Bowl matchup?
Yes, I think it's going to be the Green Bay Packers and the Indianapolis Colts, and I think the Green Bay Packers are going to win. How's that?
That's good. It means I don't have to watch any football this year.
Well, you weren't going to anyway, were you?
No.
Okay, well, there we go.
Earlier this week, Georgia wide receiver A.J. Green was suspended by the NCAA for 4 games for selling his Independence Bowl jersey to a man named Chris Hawkins, a former North Carolina player. The NCAA says Hawkins is an agent. Hawkins says, no, he's a financial advisor and a memorabilia collector. University of Georgia officials have appealed. Do they have a shot?
I think not, although I wonder how much the jersey would have been worth if it was still the Poulan Weed Eater Independence Bowl. I bet you would have gotten a lot more money for that logo.
Oh, you betcha.
And is there anybody, by the way, if you're going to alibi not being an agent, calling yourself a memorabilia dealer doesn't make you less sleazy. There's no sleazier element in sports of any kind than the memorabilia dealer. I mean, that's like pleading, you know, innocent to being a burglar because you're actually a bank robber.
Memorabilia dealers all over will be emailing, I'm sure.
Under assumed names, I'm
yes,
sure.
Yes, absolutely. In baseball, the last person to lead the National League in batting average home runs and RBIs in the same season was Joe Ducky Medwick back in 1937. Colorado Rockies outfielder Carlos Gonzalez played fewer than 100 games in each of his first 2 seasons. He never hit higher than .284, and now he is a Triple Crown contender. Safe to say he's having a breakout year?
He's having a terrific year, but once again, we have to calibrate for altitude, as we always do with everything having to do with any baseball team in Colorado.
Charlie, in international basketball news, the U.S. beat Russia on Thursday to advance to the semifinals of the World Championships in Turkey. And I understand the guy coaching the Russian team provided U.S. coach Mike Krzyzewski with some dandy blackboard material.
Yeah, David Blatt, who actually comes from not far from us in Framingham in Massachusetts, is an American who has had a wonderful kind of gypsy career coaching basketball on various parts of the planet and now coaches in Russia and has said that after further review, he doesn't think the United States was robbed in the legendary Pilford basketball game in the 1972 Olympics. As much as I will give Coach K all the credit in the world for being a humorless jackass, Mr. Blatt is wrong about this. The United States did get robbed in that game.
The U.S. team faces Lithuania later on today. How's that likely to work out?
I think the United States will win by 7 or 8 points. The Lithuanians are not as good as they were back in the day of Šarūnas Moshalenis and Arvydas Sabonis, those guys. But they're still a very, very good basketball-playing country, and I think the U.S. will have a really tough 3 quarters and probably pull away at the end.
We have another potential two-sport athlete story this week. The fastest man in the world, Usain Bolt, announced this week that when he's finished sprinting in perhaps 2 years, he would like to become a pro soccer player. You like his chances?
No, I'm not the soccer guy that you are, Bill, but doesn't Usain Bolt run the risk of being offside like on every play? I mean, he's just faster than everybody else.
You are a soccer guy enough to recognize that problem, and I think you're right because I don't think he's looking forward to a career in the goal. Fans of women's soccer will remember that Brianna Scurry was the goalie who clinched the World Cup for the U.S. against China back in 1999. She missed all but 1 game with the Washington Freedom this summer due to lingering effects of a concussion. and she announced her retirement this week. So, does she get your vote for the Hall of Fame?
Oh, there's no question. I think it can be argued very seriously that she's one of the two or three greatest women soccer players in the country's history. And I never thought she got the credit for that World Cup that she could have gotten. Maybe she should have taken off her shirt.
And finally, Charlie, Paul the Octopus successfully picked the final eight matches of the World Cup. Now he's being challenged by Grandpa the Spider Monkey. Grandpa picked four random matches at the U.S. Open correctly before finally getting one wrong. So, more proof that cephalopods have superior prognosticative powers?
Well, I'm not sure. I mean, how hard could it have been for Grandpa? He picked against all the American men.
Even a spider monkey can be smart enough to do that. Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine. He joins me each week at this time on Only a Game as well. Thanks, Charlie.
Thank you, Bill.
Spider monkey!
This weekend, disc golf amateurs from Berlin, Germany to Auckland, New Zealand will take to the links in competition. Same goes for discers in Dexter, Oregon, Waterloo, Iowa, and Southington, Connecticut. But while the amateurs have no less than 47 events to choose from, the pro players have the weekend off. What? You didn't know there were professional disc golf players? Last month, Only a Game's Karen Given visited one of disc golf's richest pro tournaments, the Vibram Open in Leicester, Massachusetts, and she came back with our story.
Ladies, you will be filmed, and we do have live scoring. If anybody gets in your way, please ask them to move. First up, Paige Pierce.
Paige Pierce, a 19-year-old from Plano, Texas, works through a few tentative practice motions before attempting to throw an 8.5-inch plastic disc over a pond, down a path, and into a metal basket hidden in the woods 805 feet away. Luckily, tournament director Steve Dodge says Paige doesn't have to do it all at once.
It's 455 to clear the pond. If you don't have that, and most of the ladies don't have that, if you don't have that, you bail off left or short, and then you punch it over. You don't want to get in the Christmas trees, you have a bad lie, and then you want to punch it into the woods and try to make your putt.
The Vibram Open is played on the Maple Hill Disc Golf Course in Leicester, Massachusetts. From Thanksgiving to Christmas, this place is a full-time, cut-your-own Christmas tree farm. But one weekend every August, this course hosts the best in the sport. With a $50,000 purse, everyone who makes the cut for the Vibram Open gets paid.
Shot.
With their opening drives out of the way, Paige and her playing partners head out in search of the discs they've just thrown, followed closely by a makeshift camera crew, a couple of fans, and caddies. Yes, there are disc golf caddies, carrying bags filled with as many as 40 brightly colored discs. Drivers are designed for distance and putters for accuracy. Some are even made to bend to the left or to the right. And Steve Dodge says just having one of each type isn't enough.
Hitting a golf ball into the water, you lose a golf ball. Throwing a disc into the water, you lose your driver. You just took your one wooden smashed over your knee. You're done. So they have a couple of them.
Most disc golf bios list the year a competitor picked up the sport. But for 24-year-old Val Jenkins, that question isn't easily answered.
Well, pretty much since I, you know, was born, my parents have been playing, so I've known the sport all my life.
Val is a three-time world champion. Her brother Avery joined her on the winner's podium in 2009, and her boyfriend Nate Doss won in 2005 and 2007. No one's getting rich, but they're all full-time professional disc golf players.
We're traveling around in an RV right now. It's tough sometimes, you know, it's like anything. You can get burned out, but, you know, we just play weekend by weekend, and, you know, it's on to the next one. If you don't do well that weekend, you got the next one to redeem yourself.
Val says there's not much time for practice while on the road. She plays every weekend and needs time to give her body a chance to heal in between. But when Cam Todd first came to the sport, all he did was play and practice for 4 years until he became world champion in 2001.
I think the first year and a half or 2 years that I played probably three rounds a day and did a five-hour putting session every day for at least 5 days a week.
Cam recently took a few years off and now finds himself struggling to get back to where he once was. But even if he never wins another world championship, Cam says disc golf will always be a big part of his life, and he doesn't mind explaining what he does.
Most people think we're professional disc goers, and I explain, no, we don't dance for a living, we throw frisbees. Most people understand it as frisbee golf, but it is disc golf. It's more compact discs made for the sport, but yeah, you have to explain yourself quite a bit.
Our 12:30 card, Nico LoCastro, Matt Oram, Dave Feldberg, Steve Brinster. We are live on the tee. Good luck, gentlemen.
The top men line up on the tee for their opening drives. Nico LoCastro does not get the foursome off to a good start.
Wow.
Nico's first drive falls short, bouncing off some rocks and into the pond. He's lost his driver and takes a penalty, costing him three throws to get to the spot his competitors reach in one. A crowd of at least 50 joins him in the walk down to the drop point. Nico settles for a five on the par four. Steve Brinster looks like he might be in trouble too, until he manages a long putt with a strange between-the-knees motion, kind of like a basketball player taking a granny shot. Disc golf has all the trappings of regular golf. Even out in the woods, there's never a lack of beer. The gallery celebrates with polite golf claps, and there's even a hushed voice commentator, Terry Miller from Wisconsin, updating online viewers of the progress.
And after a slight roll, it looks like Matty O is underneath the basket, throwing the same shot he threw yesterday with a forehand.
It'll take the men 4 hours to make their way around the course. Back at hole 18, Marielle Maller has already come in from her round. She's looking at an 11th place finish and a check for $263. Not bad for a part-time disc golfer.
I work at L.L. Bean, actually, so I have another job. I wish I didn't. There's plenty of people out here that play for a living, but I'm not one of them. But I'm still a pro.
Mariel lives in Maine, so by this tournament's standards, she's a local. But that doesn't give her any advantage when it comes to Maple Hill's most stressful hole, the 18th.
It is a long par four where you have to hit an island green at the end, and I actually tried to go for it and didn't get in, but the other two in my group did, so it was good. It's one of the hardest holes in New England, I'd say. It's one of those you think about the week before you come to the tournament. You're thinking about that hole.
Sadly, the island green on the 18th hole is neither an island nor is it green. Its approach covered with dirt brown wood chips. But the hole is challenging. The boundaries of the virtual island have been delineated with yellow rope. If your disc lands outside the rope, it's out of bounds.
Oh boy.
Come on, get in!
The island green is just one of the aspects of Maple Hill that make it a challenge, even to the best players, like five-time women's world champion Elaine King. When she's not playing disc golf, Elaine is a quality director for a pharmaceutical company in Toronto. And she says her coworkers are supportive.
Absolutely. Many, many people have heard of disc golf or frisbee golf or frolf. You know, it's been shown on an episode of Seinfeld. There's a lot of radio and TV play, especially in local channels. Every now and then you get a clip on the Golf Network, etc. The growth of the sport, I believe, is about 15% per year. So when you consider, 25 years of that, it's grown astronomically.
But even astronomical growth isn't enough to satisfy Erin Tivnan. Erin's been playing disc golf for 10 years, but she didn't even know about leagues and tournaments until just 2 years ago. Now she's telling anyone who'll listen that this sport belongs on TV.
People watch regular golf, and I feel that's very boring. So I hope the sport blows up soon. We keep thinking it's going to. So I think it'll take just one person seeing some amazing shots that some of these pros do, and I hope the world will come and watch it along with us. Join the ride. It's fun.
Before long, the top men's card emerges from the woods. Nico LoCastro has recovered from his disastrous first drive and shares the lead with fellow pro Matt Oram, who lands out of bounds on the 18th hole.
Woo!
Nico's drive finds safety on the island green, and from there it's just a short putt to the Vibram Open Championship and a check for $3,000. The Pro Tour is over for the year, but disc golf's elite will meet soon for the U.S. Championships. The women play in Jacksonville, North Carolina in 2 weeks, and the men will meet in Rock Hill, South Carolina during the second week in October. For Only a Game, I'm Karen Given.
Well, I took my dog discing and all he got fleas. All I want is fairways, I'm afraid of trees. Disc is in the bushes, I'm getting stung by bees. Well, that ain't stopping me from hitting this birdie. I hear a ching, 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 ching. I hear a ching, 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 ching. I hear a ching, 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 ching. I hear it.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Trabu. Our technical director is John Perotti. Our intern is Jack Flagler. We had help this week from Marion Wilson at WFDD in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. If you'd like to see Karen Given's disc golf photos, read my review of Lost Dogs, or check out stories past or present, please visit onlyagame.org. You can also find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Only a Game Radio. In our final words, Steve Dodge comments on disc golf fashion, especially the houndstooth hats and plaid shorts sported by the younger generation.
It's surprising to me, but just that I'm not very fashion conscious. It does matter to them. It does matter to humans.
Yes, and they do look marvelous, those humans, don't they? I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
To the next box, I let it roll, but I let it rock. Frisbee golfing all my days till my body starts to rock. And I got to be throwing.
Support for Only a Game comes from WBUR Boston, FJC, a foundation of donor-advised funds working to maximize the effectiveness of charitable giving at fjc.org. The Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, working to help reverse the childhood obesity epidemic at rwjf.org. And the Kauffman Foundation, educating entrepreneurs about how to start and grow businesses through Kauffman Fast Track at fasttrack.org. This is NPR.